Is there a place to get free rolls around here?
Yeah, right around here.
Are they any good? Okay. I'm on a mission. I'm going to go pick something up for somebody.
There's a handful of places where you can buy pre-rolled marijuana these days in New York.
Problem with that is it's a classic quality issue, you know? You never know what you're going to get. Could be Delta 9.
Yeah. Sometimes it's really good.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it's too good.
But there are several thousand, maybe like 10,000 weed stores in New York. We went from like the Rockefeller laws where you would go yeah. to prison for 20 years for selling weed to
a cornucopia,
a new, like you can walk down Wyckoff Avenue and just see seven weed stores in front of you on like the next block and a half.
Absolutely.
I'm not even exaggerating.
No, that is literally for real. That's literally what Wyckoff looks like. You know, we actually had a run-in with a unicorn a couple of weeks ago. We were on the Lower East Side.
Somebody wanted a threesome.
No, it wasn't like that. We were on the Lower East Side and we wanted to go to the store, and we found one of the only licensed ones in the entire city. It's called ConBuds. Uh-huh. This episode of the Antifada is sponsored by ConBuds.
Because it's
cons.
Because there's like like the people who get the licenses first were people who had been convicted for drug offenses.
Exactly.
And so those people are like a huge commodity to the weed sellers. Like if you just get one of those people on your board.
Yeah.
Then some of these people have come out and said, like, I'm trying to do this honestly. You know, I was convicted for selling weed in the 90s or something. And I got all of this capital lined up to start a legal weed business. But there's 20,000 illegal stores.
Of course.
And they're not taxed.
Right.
So I'm the sucker who's opening, like, the legit weed store where the weed is too expensive and shitty because it's from New York and not California.
Well, you say there's 10,000 in this city, and I believe it. I think there's like seven legal ones. It's like the fucking Wild West out here all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing too, is like it's very territorial about who gets the licenses, and there's tons of litigation about it. So the people who actually try to open them up honestly just end up in court for years. And that's why there's none in Brooklyn.
Oh, that makes sense.
I think they just opened up one in Queens.
Oh, yeah. The quality of that place, I will say, was pretty good. You walk in there and you feel like you're in an Apple store. And there's like a little kiosk that you go to and you like type in your various THC preferences and like an algorithm like decides which one you might want to get. It's all very, very high tech and fancy.
I do like weed stores like that, like especially the ones in Washington State I really like. But they're just like four times the price of one of the weed bodegas.
Yeah.
Especially now because there's so many, the prices are going way down. I got an eighth for $20 recently.
Nice.
I got a friend who visited me from California recently, and she was thinking about stocking up on weed from out here and bringing it back to California.
Wow, how the tables have turned.
Because the prices are just so low.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, classic supply and demand. As Marx famously said, supply and demand explains everything.
And this is why I would like the government to crush the illegal weed bodegas.
Yeah, you want that real shit. You want that real shit back. That's fair, man. I mean, I will say that the legal stuff is great. I like the stuff that comes from California, the edibles. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
They've got the one-to-ones out there. I mean, you can buy them here, but you don't exactly know what it is. But yeah, they bodegas.
The question that we have to ask ourselves, and perhaps the listeners as well, as we're on a podcast right now, is the ruling class attempting to stupefy us with legal soma? Are we?
Is weed the opiate of the masses?
It might be. Like, are we just one step away from insurrection, and yet we're all stupefied by the legal marijuana?
I think it is a palliative. Like, I mean,
sure is.
The reason why it's legal is because it's very good for the economy. To have farms put to use growing cannabis.
True.
And then the state next to you does it. So, like, Massachusetts legalized first. And so the result of that was just millions of dollars going across the New York border into Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And so it was only a matter of time. And New Jersey did it too, but like they had to push back against the lobbying of the alcohol lobby.
Yeah.
Does not like weed legalization.
Yeah.
And pharmaceutical lobby.
Right.
And law enforcement as well. It's like good for law enforcement to have the smell of weed be a justification.
Justification for stopping
someone for DWBs.
But they got away with that for like 100 years now, and you can't get away with it anymore.
Well, you still can because you can't drive.
Smoke and drive. Yeah.
So it still works, but it's just less. It's less, you got to plant a different drug on them now.
I'm back on the job now, and I must say that starting around 5 o'clock, as my mom would say, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, but at 5 o'clock, I'm ready for some stupefaction, man. Stupefy me. I'm ready to just let the day roll off my back.
Oh, yeah.
We're working, I'm working with a real crazy guy. I'm working with a real psychopath. You know about seed oil people?
Oh, he doesn't like the seed oils?
He hates the seed oils.
You know, there might be something to that, but those people do sound insane.
He is a Dan Bongino head, which is like some real low-hanging fruit shit. Like, I get
lowest common denominator.
Yeah, like Bongino is just a loudmouth fucking prick, but he's really super into him. And he today on the job, and we had a tough day. We had like pickaxes and shovels and shit. It was like a fucking chain gang out there. At the end of the day, he picks up a box of Hostess cakes, and he's like angrily reading off the ingredients. He's like, ingredient number one, sugar. Ingredient number two, bleached white flour. What the fuck? And then he's like,
oh, he's right,
corn
about that.
Syrup, yeah. Raw. And he's,
that shit's
folic
poison.
Acid. Yeah, it's all fucking terrible.
Yeah, well, seed oils, I don't really know much about that, but all the sugar that we eat is poison.
Oh, it's absolutely fucking dog shit and terrible.
Yeah, it just makes us eat worse foods because we're addicted to that stuff.
It somehow gets wrapped up in like the globalist agenda somehow, which everything kind of does. I mean, this guy is like really fucking angry. Like every day he tells me another story about how he like punched someone or intimidated his neighbors or like some guy. Probably the best moment in his life in decades was some guy was rooting around people's trash to try to find shit. So he managed to like isolate the guy on his Ring camera and like drive home real quick and get a shotgun.
Good. He's a rageaholic.
Oh, he's a steroids guy. You know, he's just really mad all the time. All I got to say about that is great partner, and I'm glad he's on my side. Uh-huh. That's it.
Well, I thought maybe I can talk a little bit about my work, too. This is something I haven't talked about on the show before, but we had this meeting last week.
We did.
And I'll just like quickly say my initial reaction of the meeting and why it's a good idea. In terms of what kind of group we're going to form out of it, I think it's for the best that we sort of decide that as we go. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got some ideas, we have some goals, but the most important thing is that we had a meeting, we've got people in touch with each other, and we're going to try to build something, and that's great. This is what, it's not easy, it's awkward, but this is like what everyone should be doing. Like if we're just sitting around listening to podcasts, reading articles, writing our own thing, posting, you know, that's not going to get us anywhere.
Right.
So meeting and organizing, even to the small extent that we can do, it's important. But one thing that I think has promise about this is that most of the people who came were listeners to the show.
Yep.
Who heard about the meeting on the show. And a lot of our listeners are workers. They work in a lot of different industries. Some of them are unions, some of them aren't.
I get to brag now. We had represented, and this is shout outs to all of you. We had Teamsters. We had International Union of Operating Engineers. We had Sparkies, IBEW. Of course, we had Carpenters as well. We had the
shout
trades represented.
666, IBEW.
Yeah, 666. IBEW Local 666. I even got some fucking swag.
By the way, you got the gray shirt. I got the red shirt. Do you like the gray?
I mean, red's your color. But yeah, I wore the gray to work the other day.
Yeah, the gray looks really good on you, but if you want to trade, I would trade.
Oh, well, it's got fucking oily, shitty mud from a tank from the 1950s on it right now, but
that's okay.
You can wash it off. We'll talk about it after the show.
Right.
Maybe the bonus.
Think about it.
Maybe the bonus will be us like having a discussion about
the red,
pros and cons.
It looks like pajamas, which is fine. I could use pajamas.
Yeah, I mean, it's Local 666. It's like
it's
the most evil, badass.
It's not the shirt's fault.
Seen.
It's just not as.
But yes, you were saying we. In addition to, and I don't want to like just valorize like union workers, although. Feels good to have those people on board. There were students. There were people who worked white collar jobs. There were people who, you know, were marginally employed. You know, all these people get their living through the wage fund and our workers, even the unemployed.
And so what was a little awkward about it is that because it's podcast listeners, it wasn't a very diverse group.
No, that was, oh God. Well, we have more coming down the pipe.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yes, you're right. It was very undiverse, very much like what you'd expect a podcast listeners convention to look like.
Yeah, but people were smart. There's a very good discussion. And in general, like, I know it's cool on the Dirtbag Left podcast to talk shit on your listeners and stuff, but the listeners I've met have all been like very smart, interesting people. Most of them are workers who have like really interesting perspectives on their job. And it's pretty good idea to get them together and figure out what they can do together.
Absolutely. I was very, very impressed by everybody who came. Everybody seem very dedicated, and I feel like the kind of organization we're bringing together is like a lacuna. It's like a something that's missing in the broader left right now. And I felt like all the people that showed up were like the misfit children. You know, we're the ones that still believe that old fashioned, maybe stupid conception that it's like that. You know, it's self emancipation of the working class is what politics is all about, and people living that. And I got to say, it was really good. And, you know, before we get too far into this news episode, which we're on right now, we have another meeting coming up in Queens on the 23rd of March. So we'll be putting out more information. Maybe we'll spread our net a little wider next time.
Stay tuned for that. Hit me up on the Discord. If you're a patron, you'll be on the Discord, and I can send you a link to the Telegram group. Otherwise, keep an ear out on the show, on the Patreon, on Twitter, and we'll post more information about it if you're in the New York area. And then our goal is to have groups elsewhere as well.
Yeah.
That might be down the road a bit.
And I'll say two shout outs. The first shout out is to the IBEW rank and file caucus, which is a real thing, and it's really happening. Scott from the meeting is organizing that throughout the country. It's incredible to see. And also, he pointed out that there's something cool happening, which is the Southern Workers Assembly, which is going on right now, doing sort of similar work to what we're doing.
Great. That so sounded like a very good model for what we're talking about.
So like a couple few meetings down the line, maybe by the summertime, we start reaching out to other groups who are doing similar stuff, and we make this fucking thing happen. But the news, what about the gosh dang news?
One thing I wanted to transition from about that is something that I haven't talked about on the show before.
I'm sorry.
That I mentioned at the meeting is that I was a weed delivery guy in New York for about 6 years before the pandemic started, and I started writing more full time and podcasting more full time. And before that, I did food delivery. So I was like a delivery guy for about 15 years.
An honorable trade.
But now I am a purely D-class A poster full-time, writing my book about baseball. I'm actually writing a section right now about how Doc Gooden, after he was beat up by some cops for no reason in Florida, apparently went out with some friends and a bunch of guns trying to assassinate the first cop that they saw.
Oh my God.
Which is a story I had never heard about until recently. So the book is very fun to write.
I'm sorry, but like given the history of baseball writing and like greats like Jimmy Breslin, shout out to an absolute king, I think writing baseball books is parole coded enough that you can pass. You get a parole card for that.
Well, yeah, this book I think will really assert the proletarian soul of baseball. But part of that book, and why I bring this up, is that even though I am now Antifada is a business and I'm a business owner and, you know, I have a laptop job, despite that, as much as I am not of the working class anymore, culturally or whatever, I am still on the side of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
And so just because a lot of people listening might not be workers or might have a very PMC type job, doesn't mean you can't pick sides, but it is more difficult to pick sides than you would think, because a lot of people who are sort of in my class position, D class A millennials, you know, sort of from middle class origins, I think they tend to gravitate towards the politics of the petty bourgeois. It's not necessarily fascist to like love small businesses or whatever, but ultimately we have to build a politics that is on the side of the workers and not the small business owners.
Yeah, and it has to be a politics that's the workers on the side of themselves, ultimately, too, right?
Right.
So
like all we can do is assist the workers in I think we're all on the same page on that.
Yeah. But. Yeah. Come to a meeting. It's like, hey, you come to a meeting, you walk out, maybe we'll give you a chip that says like 1 month's dedication to the proletarian cause or something like that. And as you continue to go, you know, you can share with everybody and
it'll be reverse AA. It's like, you've been drinking with us for 1 month.
Right.
Keep it up. You'll get it. You can trade this in for a 5 month. You're drinking with us, Chip.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, but that said, you don't have to be a Patreon to come to these meetings. Hit us up some other way if you're in the New York area and you're interested in coming. But at patreon.com/theAntifada, you can get access to our Discord. You get our posts about the meetups in addition to all of our bonus material.
I'll even read you the most recent thing that I wrote on the Patreon.
And the early 2024 bonus of the George Floyd Uprising book has been a pretty big success. I've sent a bunch of those out already. So I'm going to do that for maybe another month or so. If you sign up at the $10 a month level annually, which you get a 14% discount when you do that, DM me your address and I'll send you the George Floyd Uprising book, postage paid. And if you're already a patron, you can upgrade to that annual level of $10 a month and DM me and I'll send that out to you, but no purchase necessary. You can join our group even if you're just a free listener, which we love as well.
Absolutely. Do I smell like smoldering motor oil right now?
No.
Okay. Thank God. I smell it. Where do we want to start with the news today?
I think we should probably start with Aaron Bushnell. As much as I try to get my mind off what's going on in Palestine and in Gaza, it's just kind of everywhere. Like, I saw Dune last night.
Oh, Dune you 2, did? Which I'm seeing it on Sunday.
Which is fun, and obviously it's not about Gaza. I mean, it's very Middle Eastern themed. It's sure. about jihad against the empire.
Right, but, right. And against technology.
But there's a scene like pretty early on where like the Fremen are all like popping out of the desert and like attacking these spice tanks and straight out of what's the resistance has been to the IDF.
Yeah.
And then also Zone of Interest, which I saw a little while ago.
I saw that like, too, yeah.
I don't know what other people are getting out of that movie, but I'm like, this is about the experience of being an American while our government is just wholeheartedly committing a genocide.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I get that. That's one of the feelings I walked away with from that episode or from that movie rather. I have not yet seen Dune 2, Two Sand, Two Worm yet, but maybe we'll do a bonus on that when you get back from your little trip. I feel like it's impossible to ignore because every day, every week, it seems like it's a new atrocity. The most recent one, if you have to kind of like, I don't know, do the lens out on it, the fact that there were thousands of starving people who were attempting to get by any means necessary some of the limited, very limited food aid entering into northern Gaza, and they were massacred by IDF troops. Many, many died in the stampede. Many, many more, as it turns out, were shot to death.
And run over by the
Israel. That, like, every month or so when you think you've gotten used to this carnage, you know, we're now like 4.5 months into it, you think like, all right, well, this is bad, but like we understand what the stakes are and we know how bad it is. And hopefully there's some way that there'll be peace in the future. A new thing happens. And this latest thing is one of those moments where even the most like tepid milquetoast, like centrist observer has to look and say, starving people being butchered while they're like attempting to get aid and flour for their children by any means necessary. Is this escalation enough to stop America sending bombs over there? Enough for Biden to stop vetoing resolutions for a ceasefire in the United Nations? Apparently it isn't, because that scum fucking motherfucker. Who's that guy, that State Department guy? Do you see this guy come up every once in a while?
I mean, they're just all, I don't even.
Smuggest look on his face as he says, a ceasefire is not possible.
Yeah, they're, I don't even know the difference between all these people because they're all the same. And I think part of what's inspiring to so many people about Aaron Bushnell is that he's in the army. I read somewhere he was like recently assigned to either go to Israel and support whatever the U.S. is doing in operations there, or
he was in the Air Force.
He was doing IT, like, tech stuff
and cybersecurity type stuff.
And so while I guess people at the State Department and Biden and every stripe of Zionist has been able to ignore the situation or downplay it, or maybe they just, like, their souls are just dead enough that they don't care anymore because they've already, like, committed atrocities on this scale in Iraq.
Their zone of interesting it, right? Like, they are in the zone of interest right now. That's where they are.
Yeah, I mean, so with zone of interest, I think that that's closer to the reality of Israeli society, where there's
is that not the Biden administration,
well,
though?
The difference is the Biden administration has a level of remove where they could say, like, we are trying to encourage Israel to carry this out in, like, the most humane way possible. And obviously that's a lie, but, like, you can say to yourself, like, well, this isn't my war. Whereas the people who are, like, in the front lines of it are, they see it as Lebensraum, you know?
Yeah.
They're like, we're going to destroy Gaza City so we can, like, build Israeli society in Gaza City. Like, that is what the soldiers are, like, bragging about doing. And so the zone of interest is specifically, like, this Nazi family is, like, setting up a home outside of Auschwitz.
Right.
Like, oh, this is our Lebensraum. Like, we're going to be, like, these new aristocrats of this section of Poland.
Isn't it so great to get out of the big city and have some fresh air to breathe,
and
our children can
and
play
everything.
In the river and stuff. The river that might be filled with human skulls from the massacres, yeah.
So it's easy in the United States to feel, like, a few steps removed from that because we're still living our, like, somewhat shitty lives, but the massacres and plunder and everything that, like, U.S. empire is based on is becoming way more visible right now, and people are dealing with that discomfort in a lot of different ways, and Aaron Bushnell dealt with it in one way.
Yeah.
And in the show notes, I really recommend reading the Crime Think statement about this.
It was a wonderful statement.
Because Aaron Bushnell was an anarchist, and he wrote to Crime Think, among other, like, far left media outlets that he liked and trusted, to make sure that his story wasn't suppressed. Because somebody in Atlanta also self-immolated in December, and we don't really know the story of that person.
They covered themselves in a Palestinian flag and lit themselves on fire, and I think they might have survived, right? Is that the story?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the story is just, like, totally suppressed and outside the media, so, like, only people in Atlanta really know anything about it, and they can't get any more information. But Aaron Bushnell tried to make sure people knew who he was and why he was doing it, and did a good job of, like, making sure it was a story.
Yes.
Which it was. So Crime Think releases the statement that is, I think, a very sober look at it. And I think their conclusion is really important, which is something I felt too, because when I see everybody posting about it and the way they're posting about it, I think people really identified with him in the sense that, like, they're hopeless. They've been protesting. Friends of mine have been protesting every week, multiple times a week, for months now. And it's dawning on people that what are these protests really accomplishing is delegitimizing the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats are largely okay with it.
Mm.
Like, Biden and Harris and other Democrats just can't campaign right now because everywhere they go, they're being shouted down. And that hasn't really made them change anything. Like, you've still got Biden holding an ice cream cone, lying about there being a ceasefire, which, you know, Israel and Hamas were both like, Biden is just making this up. It's not happening. They are okay with losing the election and blaming the voters for it. They're totally fine with it. But then people more like us or closer to us, like Aaron Bushnell, are like, I can't handle this anymore. I can't keep simply protesting. And the point that Crime Think makes, which is really important, is that it is true that there's this sense that protests and the normal channels and voting have proven to be a dead end. But suicide and self-immolation is not the way to go. Like, we need people to organize and fight and think about new ways to fight and think this thing through to the best of our capabilities. And just because we don't have any answers doesn't mean that the solution is suicide. And I totally agree with that. I think, like, you know, I can't, I don't know what Aaron Bushnell was going through. I am not going to say that he was crazy or a coward or mentally ill or whatever.
Coward.
I think
he's about as brave as anybody we could ever imagine.
Yeah, I don't think that suicide is cowardly or the result of being mentally disturbed or crazy or whatever, but I think everybody who wants to be in the struggle is worth way more alive in the struggle.
We need to be alive. I mean, we need to live. We need to live to fight. We need to live to dream. We need to live together. You keep saying that Biden and the administration is lying. And I think to an extent they are, but it's kind of worse than lying. It's they sincerely believe on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's a public relations stunt. It's media management, just like anything else, just like the rollout of the Inflation Adjustment Act, just like anything else. It's a cold-hearted, cold-blooded attempt to make real their, I think, their strongly held belief in Israeli sovereignty and the justness of the Israeli cause, which in my mind is way worse than just lying, right? Like if they were cynically attempting to pull the wool over our eyes, it'd be one thing, but they're using all the resources in their arsenal, the American state, all of their propaganda resources available to try to put a spin on, to put a sheen upon absolute atrocities and massacres. And I think the casualties in Gaza are now up over 100,000 if you include dead, missing, and injured, including a lot of amputations and a lot of fucking orphans. The scarier thing to understand is that these motherfuckers believe this, that this is actually in their view a righteous cause, and that the each and every death of a Palestinian child is the price worth paying for them to stand up for their ally, to stand up for democracy in the Middle East. That's what should give us pause.
I'm not sure they believe in it, but it's a kind of a moot point.
It doesn't matter whether they personally believe in it. It's a tenant of their entire ideology and political philosophy. Yeah. And it goes way beyond their own personal feelings, of course, right? Because the inertia behind this entire event that we've seen since October 7th is like a structural one. As things get worse and worse, as they continue to flail to try to justify the horrific, horrific thing, the kind of shit that makes you want to cry. Like when you see the video that the IDF posted, which made these poor starving people, people on the edge of death, people on the edge of cannibalization, which is something that a lot of Israelis are laughing about and cheering for, is when the moment comes that cannibalization becomes the best option for Palestinian people. When you see the videos they post, highly edited ones that make these starving people look like ants in an anthill, just attempting to get enough flour to feed their children. This is the kind of shit that makes you want to cry. This is the kind of shit that makes you want to throw your hands up in the air and say, enough already. Like, what is the point? Aaron Bushnell got to the point where this was more important to him than his own life. He was apparently, he grew up a deeply Christian person in like a semi Christian cult in Massachusetts, and he transitioned from that to anarchism. No doubt in his young life, no doubt as he grew up in this highly Christian environment, what was imprinted upon him was the sacrifice that Jesus Christ made, right? Allegedly for the sins of all mankind. Well, he sacrificed himself in a very similar way, sacrificed him not on a cross, but by fire, which, as the Crime Think piece is very eloquent in talking about, fire is a long time, self-immolation is a long time form of protest, but it's the flip side, it's the mirror image of the immolation that is capitalist war in the 20th century and the 21st century. You know, what is the firebombing of Tokyo but immolation? What is Hiroshima and Nagasaki? What are the ovens of Auschwitz but immolation? Right?
Vietnam.
And just Vietnam and napalm deaths in Vietnam, the road of death in Iraq, the white phosphorus over Fallujah. Like, empire is built on immolation. And this one man and the fucking rhetoric online has just been fucking deranged, as though this is going to start some trend of like self-immolation. Like, we're also interested now because we're all social media heads. We're all like inculcated in this fucking environment that we think about virality all the time. The idea that like all these people are going to start self-immolating over this, or that this man is like completely deranged and he was psycho and suicidal and that's why he did these things. This man made the ultimate sacrifice, and he did it in the most horrifying and painful way that one could ever fucking imagine. And the thing that gets people the most in like centrist liberal society now is that somebody would believe enough in something to sacrifice themselves consciously for other people. I don't think that anybody out there should self-immolate, but you have to understand where this came from, right? And you have to understand, like the excellent Crime Think article talks about, that self-immolation is the flip side of the immolation of empire. And that's what he fought against. And we should be doing so too, in our own way.
There was a protest in Portland on February 28th where a group called About Face, Veterans Against the War, were burning their uniforms in solidarity with Palestine and Aaron Bushnell. So, and there's been a number of vigils and events celebrating Aaron Bushnell in New York and mourning him and coming to terms with like what it means to resist now, what it means to stop supporting the United States' ability to continue to support this and other wars. And so he's inspired like a new phase of this moment.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that that phase doesn't continue moving more towards hopelessness and like, well, what can we do other than become martyrs in one way or another? And people are inspired by, for example, what he was doing in San Antonio, doing mutual aid stuff, Food Not Bombs. And I'm sure we're going to learn more about the way he performed or didn't perform his job or sabotaged his job to some extent the way that he could. I think probably if he refused his orders, he would have gotten some sort of charge.
He would have got sent to the brig. I mean, listen, there's a somber truth at the center of what this man did when he poured gasoline accelerant on himself and lit himself on fire, which is that Israel is Israel, right? Maybe you're Israeli listening to this, but most likely you're in the Anglophone world. You're in the United States of America or Canada or somewhere. Israel is Israel, and it is a brutal and sick and at least semi-fascistic society. But if you want this to stop, of course, right, that's that the end to this has to begin here, because of course Israel, like any other state in the world, at least within the American orbit, which is most of them, couldn't be doing what it's doing without the support, the bipartisan support, let's say, of the United States and America, of America. So Aaron Bushnell understood that any hope for changing this shit has to come from destroying the American empire. And I hate to say it, but the American empire can only be destroyed from the inside. And he did his sacrifice for that, and we need to do our own sacrifice for that as well. Whatever we do, we need to ensure that this decrepit, decaying empire falls before the end of our lifetimes, because
that's probably the best actual way to support Palestinians.
Absolutely.
Is to destroy the U.S. empire. And yeah, part of that is, in a way, continuing to do what we're doing on every level, mutual aid, protesting.
Shit, if I was in Michigan, I would have done it uncommitted. I would have fucking signed up uncommitted, in, you know, every little bit.
Vote uncommitted. I mean, obviously there's limitations to that, but there's limitations to everything that we talk about. So people got to think about what they can do and do it. So let's move on from there to labor stuff. Strike updates.
So labor. Let's discuss labor. What are you drinking there?
Spicy hot chocolate stout.
Wow. That sounds cool.
Try it.
I don't really like it
that much, but it was on sale.
Yeah. Classic Andy move.
I've got a train ride tomorrow, so I thought a stout would be a good thing to bring because it doesn't have to be cold.
I actually don't dislike that at all. Yeah, you're taking the Amtrak, huh?
That's right.
That's beautiful. It's a beautiful
thing.
Just
like my hero, Joe Biden.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say Woody Guthrie. Although I guess he died too young to ride Amtrak. Guy who thinks Amtrak's from the 19th century. Riding the rail.
I'll dress like a hobo, but I am using Amtrak miles for the ticket.
Nice. Labor, labor, labor. Let's belabor this. Let's be belabored. We were going to talk a little bit about the United Auto Workers, who are reprising their role from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s and 70s as like the central spoke around which American labor spins, the central hub in the wheel of American labor. They're laying claim to leadership of the working class again. Can you believe it?
I didn't know they were doing that, but...
Of course they are.
Kind of problematic of them, but...
Well, yeah. You know, if...
Let's see what you got.
What is leadership of the working class except claiming it? You have to claim it and see what happens. That's what we'll do with our group someday. We'll tell the Central Labor Council, go fuck yourselves. We're taking over. But in the meantime, incredible results coming down the pipe in the Dirty South. You know, attempts, looks like they're going to be successful to organize in non-union foreign maker plants. You know, this whole second sphere, the second tier of the American auto industry, which is, you know, from the 1970s and 1980s when American auto makers, the big three, started to face competition from the foreign makers. We put up a bunch, the government put up a bunch of tariffs to make sure that those cars were assembled in the United States, and all of those auto plants were runaway shops that ran down south to take advantage of cheap labor in the right to work non-union states. Well, as it turns out, the wheel turns again. And I think in a Volkswagen plant, in a Hyundai plant, and Mercedes-Benz plant in Alabama and Tennessee, it looks like we're getting 30, 50, 70% union election cards signed by the membership, which means, you know, we probably break into the South for the first time since Operation Dixie.
Yeah, so the significance, because we talked about this on the last episode, but the significance of the recent news is that in terms of the cards that are coming back for union membership, the numbers are significantly higher than I think people had expected. Is
higher and quicker than last union, failed union campaigns.
Now, let me ask you something about this, because I've been researching baseball, I'm so baseball brain, but I was reading about how the minor league union won. I was listening to Tony Clark, who's the president of the MLBPA, and he said a big reason for that was the pandemic, not only because conditions became so much more precarious for baseball players and minor league baseball players specifically, but because they were able to do online card signings for the first time.
Oh,
probably an NLRB rules change, right? Yeah, for the pandemic.
They changed the voting so that Biden could steal the election. Yeah.
So over the course of about a week, I think, they got such a high number of union cards signed digitally that the baseball owners basically had to look at it and say, all right, you have the union. And they voluntarily recognized it.
Yeah.
And there's other reasons for that, too. I think it's possible that if they thought this was going to be an inevitability, it was just better for them to normalize it.
Yeah.
And say, we already negotiate with this union. So instead of just fighting this and it spinning out of control, we might as well just recognize it directly. But do you think this is a sort of a similar situation? Because the Starbucks workers this week won this massive union recognition.
They agreed to recognize the union, and now they're going to start bargaining for real.
And which is huge. I mean, this was something, I remember when I first moved to the city in the mid-2000s, the IWW was working on unionizing Starbucks stores and got didn't go very far. They got a few stores had some members were allowed to be union members, which was a step in the right direction. But now we're looking at a situation where Starbucks could go the way of drug stores and grocery stores, where it's just sort of standard that if you have a a certain amount of hours at this job for a certain amount of time, you're going to be in a union.
Yeah. Shout out to my local food town, a union run and worker owned shop even too. Yeah. Starbucks, breaking through with Starbucks is incredible. And the fact that at this late date, and it's hard to tell how much of this was like the massive militant support among the rank and file with this union as they tried to fire people over and over again in various different stores, like throughout the Midwest and the Northeast. They kept trying to fire people as though the people that came behind them weren't going to be supporting it as well. They attempted intimidation with captive worker meetings, which is something that's happening in the auto plants down south right now. They really threw everything at it, all everything that the union avoidance industry could do. And they failed, and these people have stuck to it. These workers have stuck to it. And so I think they are finally recognizing the reality on the ground, which is that they're not going to be able to avoid this. I think the public relations of it starts to look really bad, especially since Starbucks has always claimed to be like to have associates, not workers, right? So it's an incredible breakthrough. It's an incredible breakthrough happening right now in retail, and it's an incredible breakthrough happening right now in college campuses with adjunct professors. I think that just came out yesterday that the NYU workers have formed the largest private non-tenure track education union in the entire country, and I think also been recognized by NYU as a bargaining partner under the UAW, which is incredible stuff. So it feels like a tide is turning. The flip side of this, and what you'll hear all the time in the liberal press, because this ups the Biden administration and their executive function over the National Labor Relations Board, is that all these unions are pushing really hard because pretty soon Trump is going to come in and they're going to overturn a bunch of the judicial rules about union elections. But irrespective of that, it's a pretty exciting time.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a step in the right direction. I mean, like the volume of unionization is still decreasing every year as people retire and die.
Yeah. But as jobs are just lost and never coming back. Derek Varn, of course, shout out to Varn, will always mention that the union, like the absolute numbers of union members are continuing to drop during the course of this these actions.
But I mean, that's like it. We were already in a place where the workers' movement and unions were very weak, and you're starting to see workers flex their muscles in different
Absolutely.
Ways, starting to exercise. And that can only be a good thing, although, yeah, we shouldn't be deluded enough to think that the workers' movement is back or something like that.
Yeah, but, you know.
But it's going to come back because people can't just keep swallowing shit forever.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, like I'm a communist realist in this way, right? Like, I feel like we on the communist or socialist or anarchist left, we who are behind labor, we throw everything we can at it, and we hope to build like a proletarian movement that could overcome, that could aufheben the shit out of everything. But if the worst thing that we do at the end of our lives, at the end of our organizing, is help like hundreds of thousands or millions of people live with just a little bit more dignity and have just like enough wages to just kind of like make their way through life, maybe send their kids to school or whatever, I think that's a positive.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, the immediate goal of this stuff, of course, is just to make your life more bearable while you're working. Like if you're a Starbucks worker or an auto worker or an adjunct, you know, like you've got to be able to have some authority over your own job and your own working conditions. And that's a win in itself. Another article I found that I'll post in the show notes is that the UAW announced a project to earmark some of their funds to support independent unions that are forming in Mexico,
yeah,
in the places where they're starting to building some stuff that are sent to the United States to assemble, which I don't know, maybe that's just UAW propaganda. I want to be as cynical as possible, but
no, seems like
a good thing.
I read the press release that came out from UAW, and then I tried to search various different articles like the Detroit Free Press and Politico and elsewhere, but basically like repetitions of the press release. Right. So, and this is going to sound so journalistic of me. This is going to make me sound like I'm not just some fucking asshole. But I reached out to a source within the UAW this podcast.
WSWS style.
Yeah. And I said, hey, what's up, man? Hello, fellow worker. Do you have any more information on the Mexican solidarity thing? And all I got back was like, not yet. So there's very little flesh on the bones of this new enterprise. But we can pick up like a recurring theme here, right? Whether it's the UAW attempting to do what was undoable, which is organizing in the South, or whether it is the UAW under Sean Fain attempting to mitigate the wage differential between Mexican auto workers, where a lot of, not just a lot of auto industry is going, but if you look at the numbers, for the first time in 25 years recently, I read this in the Financial Times, trade with Mexico, industrial trade is higher than that with Mexico. I'm with China now. So like Mexico is taking the place as like the low cost, low wage, like trade partner of last resort for the United States. So the point is that if you're trying to equalize the wages, trying to get Alabama workers and Tennessee workers under a union contract that equalizes their wages from north to south, from the Midwest into the deep south or out west and to the east, you're creating the sort of playing field where all of a sudden now capital doesn't have quite the power to move in ways that, you know, undermine workers' capacity to self-organize and express their power and potentially build something greater than just a union, you know? Same, of course, goes with Mexico. So if the United Auto Workers under Sean Fain are now serious about being, dare we say, internationalist about their union campaigns and starting to work across these borders, I know there's a lot of cynics out there who, you know, so, oh, this is just business unionism, or they're just trying to tie these workers to the gears of the boss's contracts or whatever. Yeah, fair enough. All well and good. But the point is imagine our capacity to do organizing and to fight for our own living and our own rights. If all of a sudden now the wage differential that capital faces between Alabama and Detroit is eliminated. God forbid, even imagine, as it is between US and Canada right now, that the wage differential between Monterrey, Mexico, and Alabama and Detroit is all of a sudden mitigated. Now workers are fighting on the same terrain, and capital doesn't have the power to use geography to undermine workers' power. Right. So this could only be good for all of us.
You're saying that even if it is just business unionism, it's a necessary step for the business union project to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sean Fain is a reflection of the United Auto Workers and their, what it would be now, 90 year history, like running up against the walls of what was possible under the old, like, reformist business union regime, and now expressing like the absolute necessity of wage labor in this particular moment to like move beyond itself and have to start facing things nationally and internationally in order to even retain like the shitty declining packages that have existed for the last 50 years.
And also thinking politically, like if you compare the way Fain has been talking and the sort of tendencies within the UAW rank and file that he's been giving voice to, like including Palestine, I'm not sure if he said anything directly about it, but a lot of UAW workers have passed resolutions, mm-hmm. or locals have passed resolutions calling for a ceasefire. Yep. If you compare that to the AFL-CIO, for example, which seems to be, I mean, it looks like they're more stridently anti-political than ever. And this is where you get Trump calling Sean Fain an idiot.
Yeah.
For like supporting Biden instead
and
of
maybe
him.
Getting a Teamsters endorsement next year, this year, but we'll see.
You think Trump will get a Teamsters endorsement?
Right. Nixon got one. Why not Trump? Why not Trump?
But why would Trump get the endorsement?
Because Trump's...
he's going to win?
He's going to win, first off, but also like... If you're a Teamster, you want to, as they've done for so many years, you want to, you know, play both sides against the middle. You want to hedge your bets a little bit. And, you know, in a pure, like, apolitical, Gompers-esque union, mentality like right. we have as the default in the United States. Sure, it makes sense. You know, Trump comes in, Teamsters did something for him. Maybe he'll do something for them.
I guess the question is, the broader question is, like, what is the role of unions in this country? Is it simply to protect its narrow rank and file, or is it to expand through, you know, organizing the disorganized, supporting emerging union tendencies in this country and elsewhere, and taking political stances that are either deeply within the day-to-day life of workers, or even somewhat without, even outside the factory floor. Is the union movement going to be political and international and expanding, or is it going to be narrow and protective?
And yeah, no, that's the ultimate question, right?
And the ultimate question is, like, what's the better strategy for these unions? And our argument, of course, would be the better strategy is to have all of the workers united in solidarity,
yeah.
fighting for one another, instead of just a narrow group of workers fighting for themselves and their own interests. Because that might win you a concession from Trump in the short term, but you'll be crushed in the long term, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, oh God, where do you even start with this? Like, one of the things I've talked about on this show for a long time, and one of the very basic things that I hope to work with people on in this group that we're starting is the incredible disparities that exist between union construction labor in, say, New York City and non-union. And there's, like, very real and practicable things that you can do that always run up against the law, right? The legality of these what is actually possible right now. I'm not saying that, like, the internationalization of the Sean Fain and the UAW's solidarity work can take the place of, you know, like, say, organizing undocumented workers in the trades in New York City in order to try to find some justice and some solidarity between people who have been here and people who are coming. But things, as you say, necessarily have to lead towards that direction if you're going to have even the basics of business unionism left in this country. And if you look at the polling, and I know polls, you know, like, we all grew up on Noam Chomsky, and he loves polls or whatever, and he thinks that they're, like, a good reflection of where people are at. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But, like, if you look at polls, unions are polling really fucking high and have been, especially among young people. I feel like this is the perfect opportunity, you know, within this podcast and without this podcast, everywhere in this country, for people to start seeing this as a venue of struggle that is opening up in our lifetimes, which is to say the larger working class struggle, reformist struggle, you could say, in order, you know, to try to gain some decency, some living wages in the course of this process of multipolarity, of reshoring, of renationalization of production, of neo-mercantilism, of neo-techno-feudalism, or whatever you want to call it, right? We have a unique opportunity right now where we can start to act. We can be fish swimming in these waters. And I am going to try my damnedest, and I know Andy is too, and I know many of the listeners too, to make the potentials of this a reality, which is to say to try to take this from, like, a flash in the pan moment where it's possible to organize a Starbucks union or a union down south, to turn this into a movement that's greater than simply the idea of unionizing a particular factory or a particular industry, a movement that's based on proletarian self-organization, the creation of an entire civil sphere where the working class can gain hegemony and preponderance over the middle classes and the capitalist classes. I think that, you know, despite all the terrible things happening in this world, despite the great calamities that are coming down the pipe with climate change and economic crisis or whatever, I think there are reasons to hope. I think there are reasons to not, you know, necessarily take the self-immolation option, to live on this world and to fight in this world, to fight with, you know, the people around us for a better world. And I still do think that is possible. And we see this in the most mundane things, including what's happening in the union movement right now. So exciting stuff.
Yeah. So there's something I want to talk about. Maybe we'll transition to the bonus right now, which is that there was a wildcat strike yesterday. We're recording this on Friday. And on Thursday, the ACE trains were running on a 30-minute delay and probably longer than that.
Aren't they always? Am I right, folks?
Well, a worse delay than normal. And I didn't take those trains yesterday, but I took another train that had some kind of weird delays too, so it affected the entire system. And that was a result of one of the train operators being slashed in the face at a stop in the Rockaways. And as a result of that, a number of workers, I think, called in sick or had a slowdown on the job. It was a wildcat strike yesterday that caused those delays, as a way of expressing that they're fed up with the violence that they're receiving on platforms. And I think this raises some interesting questions I want to talk to you about.
So. Yeah, let's talk to them in the bonus section.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Because really it comes down to the question of like safety and cops in the subway.
All right, well that
and is, cops in society in general.
Yeah, let's do it. If you're not a patron, we just don't know what you're doing with your life. It sounds stupid. It sounds really deplorable.
I don't think it's okay not to be a patron.
Yeah, but, no.
If you want to hear the episodes, sign up at patreon.com/theantifada. And if you can't afford it, just hit me up and I'll send you the episode.
And we don't hate our patrons, unlike other podcasts out there. We actually love our listeners. You guys are the best.
We tend to like our listeners.
Yes. We tend to.
Yeah.
More updates on that meeting, too, coming down the pipe soon. So maybe we'll see you on the 23rd. But in the meantime, see you in the bonus half.